This is Scamapalooza, a podcast about lies, scams, and illusions, and why we fall for them. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And today's show is brought to you by Slight Night, a new monthly magic show at the Laneway Theatre in Northcote, Melbourne, here in Australia. This is a monthly magic show with up to four different magicians every single month performing magic the way it was supposed to be formed, up close and personal, right under your nose. I had the chance to check out the venue last week and it is absolutely phenomenal. Even the people in the back row can see every detail of the playing cards right in front of them. It's going to be a fantastic show and it will be running every month from now. The first show is already sold out, but there are tickets available for October. Check out conman.com.au for more information. Now, on with the show. What would you say is the best method of detecting lies? A truth serum, a polygraph machine, a body language expert? The truth about lie detectors is they probably don't work. So why do they show up in popular culture, on reality TV, and perhaps most disturbingly, in criminal investigation? And what are the ramifications of putting our faith in these dodgy devices and half-baked theories? On this episode of Scamapalooza, Dr. Celine Van Gold of the Not Guilty Project helps uncover the truth about lies. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scamapalooza.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I was thinking like what would be a good place to start when talking about lies and lie detection. Yep. What, from a psychological standpoint, what is the definition of a lie?
Well, of course, we try to define it as soon as you do research on a specific topic, because research, one of the most important parts is that it can be replicated. In order for it to be able to be replicated, you need to define what you're looking at. So the definition of a lie within forensic psychology is often described as trying to convince another person of something that the communicator considers to be untrue. And it needs to be a deliberate attempt. So you need to be deliberately trying to deceive someone else. My main research area is memory. And some people can create false memories. If you have a false memory of an event, that's not the truth. You try to convince someone else, but it's not deliberate because you perceive what you're trying to say to someone else is true. So with lying, you intentionally want to convince somebody else of something that you believe is not true.
And if I told a lie to you, but then kept telling that lie over and over and over again, does it reach a point where I start to believe my own lie, even if I know sort of in my heart of hearts that it's false? Does it become less of a lie because from a psychological point, because yep. I start to believe my story that I've told so many times?
If we can objectively verify that it was untrue and that you deep down inside know it's untrue, it's still a lie. But you have a lot of people that deceive themselves. So within the detection literature, we often say a lie needs to be between two people. So we don't look at self-deception because that happens all the time. It's actually quite a normal psychological construct that we use to make ourselves feel better about certain situations. If you look from that definition, if you are at a certain point truly convinced yourself about your own lie, it wouldn't be a lie anymore because you believe that is true.
Is it possible then to kind of measure lying in a practical sense, or to actually, you know, to know whether something is a lie or not if the person has to kind of admit that it was a lie in order for you to be able to tell how successful you were in detecting it?
Yep. So what we often do is we make people commit a mock crime. So we make them steal $100 or we make them steal certain things. And then afterwards we say, you're going to be interviewed. And if the person cannot detect, and you have to lie about your involvement, so you have to lie about you having like stolen this money. And if you are able to persuade the other person that you are innocent, so that you're lying, well, they don't know that you're lying, you can keep the money. And then you can film their behavior, but you can also see at the same time if the other person is able to detect if the person is lying or not. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah, because you have some hard evidence to try and back it up.
Yes, and there's different ways that you can do it. So you can do it when there's like a big incentive for the person that is lying to be as convincing as possible. And then you can say to the person that is trying to detect if the person is lying or not, also like, well, if you are successful in determining if this person's lying or not, you also get an award. And there's a lot of different ways that that researchers have tried to recreate a situation where a person is like needs to lie and has this big incentive to get away with their lie.
How important is the incentive in the lie telling? I mean, does that make it harder to lie, or does it make it easier to lie? What is the, because I could tell a lie about something that I don't care about, and I assume with relative ease, but as soon as you ask me, as soon as you lay money on the table, for example,
It's
I
like
wonder whether I would be, I don't know if I'd be better or worse at it. It does incentive play a big role?
I think there's like really big individual differences, and that is the whole issue with lie detection anyway, because we're relying on certain abilities of people or to look at certain signs that might be there, that might not be there to determine if someone is lying. Some people are just natural liars, and incentive will only like enable them to lie better. The reason why we often use it within our field of research is because you want to mimic a situation where there's a lot of stakes. So, for example, involvement within a crime, where if you get caught, you're going to go to jail. And of course, we can, for ethical reasons, we cannot actually make people commit like real crimes and put them through like traumatic experiences. So we try to mimic it with certain incentives. But it really depends on the person. Some people get too nervous because there's too much at stake, while other people think like, oh yeah, I've got this. And they just like get away with it super easily.
So, having had a look at the various literature, what are some of the most common things people think of when they think of lie detection? I mean, for example, the classic one for me is always the where you look. That people talk about looking up and to the left and down and to the right and all of those kind of things that will be able to tell if someone is lying or telling the truth. Has that been discredited, that idea?
That has been massively discredited. There's different ways that you can look at lying. So, for example, you can look at verbal and nonverbal behavior. So, eye movements, where are people looking, but also overall hand movements, if there's less or more nodding, if they make more mistakes when they're talking, more word fillers like and ah, if there's a delay in their answer. But you can also look at physiological changes, and then you go into the area of like polygraph testing, or what's commonly known as lie detectors. There's been a really big research study done by different groups all over the world, and they're called the Global Deception Detection Investigation Team or something like that. They have an official name. It's really cool. But what they've technically done, it's in over 50 countries. They asked a lot of different people, so university students, but also normal community members. And they gave them questionnaires, and they asked them like, okay, so what do you think is a nonverbal cue or a verbal cue of lying? So how do liars behave? And they found that's like taken, and so there's 50, over 50 different countries. So independent of culture, people thought that fidgeting was one main sign of lying, and the other one, and I just now forgot what the other one was, but it is there's two main nonverbal cues, and everybody believes anywhere around the world that though gaze aversion, that those are indicative of lying. So if someone doesn't like is averting their gaze because they try to not look you in the eye, or if they start fidgeting with their fingers and their hands, and those are signs of nervousness, and therefore they must be lying.
So that would make you, if you wanted to be a better liar, you need to establish good eye contact and not fidget. But
Yep.
if you, but the reverse isn't true, that just because someone does fidget or does the they guess doesn't mean they are lying, or are they more likely to be lying? I mean, can we even say that?
Nope.
Oh.
So what they've done, so this is just what people believe, what the general public
Right,
believes. But
okay.
if we then look at the literature, and what they've done is they've done all these studies, and they may put people into situations where they had to tell a lie. Sometimes there was a very big incentive, sometimes it was just a lie about anything. Now, if you compare hundreds of people, you see that yes, fidgeting and gaze aversion sometimes are things that come up, but it's mostly fidgeting. There's more mistakes, like more speech errors, and people start to move less overall. So there's more less limb movement and nodding, and that is because lying is quite cognitively depleting, it's quite difficult because people have to make sure that what they're talking about is consistent with what they said before, or maybe what somebody else already knows. So you have to think really hard. And because you're thinking so hard, you actually start to move less and you might make more errors in your speech. Now, if you take hundreds of people, you will see that, yeah, these are signs that consistently come up. But the big problem is then you want to apply those signs that come out if you have hundreds of people to the one individual person. And unfortunately, only when you know that person really well, you know what their baseline behavior is. Some people are just more extrovert than other ones. Some people are more introvert. And the other problem is that all these signs are caused by either nervousness or because people are thinking really hard. But what if you're telling the truth and somebody is putting you on the spot and says, oh, what did you do 3 weeks ago on a Tuesday? And like, it could be a police officer, could also be a significant other that's accusing you of something. That's really difficult. So you start to think really hard as well. And you actually show exactly the same signs as someone that's lying, but not because you're lying, but just because you're thinking hard, or maybe because you're really nervous because the person is angry with you or trying to accuse you of something that you don't know the answer to. Maybe you don't want to be falsely accused. So the issue is that, yes, liars might show those signs, but innocent people as well. So you just cannot make the distinction.
So it may be, for example, that I personally am someone who, when they lie, will avert my gaze. But the next person that you interview may just be someone who doesn't like making eye contact or doesn't do it. I've actually, because I wear glasses and I've needed glasses for years but never got them, and because I could just kind of get by without them. But it meant that when I was talking to people, I'd often have trouble focusing on their face, and so I'd spend a lot of time looking over people's shoulders and either looking like I was trying to avert their gaze or looking like I was kind of disinterested with the conversation. Just like, just purely because I couldn't focus. So would that would be sort of an example of me looking shifty.
Yep. Very shifty.
Which I already have a problem with that.
And it happens as well with cultural differences. In certain cultures, it's very inappropriate to look someone in the eye, and specifically an authority figure. So they avert gaze and they are considered completely like dodgy at that point as well. It's not just like the differences in personality and individual differences in behaviors overall, but I think the main issue is that we always use the emotion in between to determine if someone is lying. So the idea is you're telling a lie, you're nervous because you don't want to get caught, or you want to get away with it, and that nervousness is causing specific behaviors. But you can be nervous for a lot of different reasons, not because you're lying. And that keeps on being the main issue. There's a really big focus now on trying to look at the cognitive aspect of it and actually see if people, trying to increase the cognitive load when you're interviewing someone, so making them think harder, because then they start to make mistakes because it becomes such a difficult task to maintain, and that's when they start slipping up. And because it's then inconsistent with other evidence that you might have, you can determine if they're lying or not.
Right. But that would be different from, say, lie detection, and that would more be an investigation or interrogation technique. Is that right? Like, so it's more a way of making someone accidentally tell you the truth or accidentally give you a piece of information they didn't mean to, as opposed to like they are lying and you can tell. So that's that's something that comes up a lot when people talk about lie detection, is that it seems like lie detection, when used practically, so when used, I mean, we're talking about law enforcement, I guess, mostly, is that the lie detectors, and whether that's reading, you know, the verbal and nonverbal cues or the polygraph machines or any of those things, seem to be less used as a method of actually finding out whether they're lying or telling the truth, and more as a way of intimidating people into confessing. Yes. In that if you strap someone to a polygraph and have like a serious man in a suit shaking their head at you every 30 seconds or so, you're more likely to sort of, you know, give up the fact. Is that something, is that why, you know, lie detectors and these kind of things are successful? I mean, when I say successful, they are practical. There's something that there is a practical use to.
Yes. So if we look at polygraph tests itself, they're not admissible. Any evidence gathered with a polygraph is not admissible in court in Australia. And that's just because it's too unreliable, because people that are innocent get really nervous as well, get exactly the same physiological changes. So we don't use that. But the main part of a polygraph is actually the main essence is to convince the person that's doing the test that a polygraph works. Because if they are convinced that it works, they're more likely to actually show the specific signs of nervousness when they're telling the truth or when they're lying. And often when it's inconclusive, because the majority of the time it can actually be inconclusive, they just say like, oh, the polygraph showed us this. It's better for you to confess. It's better for everyone if you now confess, because confession evidence is available, is admissible in courts. Saying that, in Australia, the news of the police force will never use a polygraph test.
Just purely because of it's useless in terms of the evidence that it actually brings up.
Yeah. And it's so unreliable. Yeah, it's also too unreliable. It's been shown too many times. But if you go to other countries like the United States, and even certain countries like Israel or Japan, they use different, you've got different types of polygraph tests, and they sometimes still use it in investigative procedures.
There is a famous story, which you must have heard before, about the it was back in the 70s, and the criminal who's been investigated, and he got strapped to a photocopier. I think they put a colander on his head and then attached wires to the colander into the photocopy machine. Yep. I cannot for the life of me find out if that story is true or not. Who do I have to strap to a lie detector to find out if that really happened? Because the story was that every time they thought he was lying, they just pressed the print button and a piece of paper came out that said lie, and he ended up confessing. Have you heard that story? Do you know if that's true or not?
I've heard that story before, but I don't know if it's true or not. But it's brilliant, though. Something that I would like to try with people.
Because I guess that is an example of what you're talking about, is that it's making people give up the information of their own free will.
Yep.
Nonverbal cues, there's not really a lot of information. And verbal cues, there's not a lot of evidence. Polygraphs, there's not a lot of evidence that they work. What else do we have? What are the other options that we have for finding out if people are lying or not?
They've been trying a few things. So if we look at the physiological measures, they've been trying to look at certain brain waves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's specifically one called a P300, and it's a recognition brain wave. So what you show is people, like, you either let them listen to different words or you show them different photos. And then instead of, like, if you're an innocent person and you have no idea about, for example, a crime scene, then you can look at all the photos, you can hear all the words, but one doesn't, like, you don't get a recognition type brainwave.
Uh-huh.
However, if you've committed a crime and you've got some guilty knowledge about that specific crime, you might recognize specific aspects of a crime that an innocent person might not. And then you'll see the brainwave for those aspects. They've tried to do that with fMRI as well, but it's all not very reliable. There is something called microexpressions, and it started off as quite an interesting approach to lie detection and to nonverbal cues again. So what the idea was, it's again to do with emotion, and it's that every person will feel a specific type of emotion when they're talking about a past event. And even when you're lying, right before, because people try to suppress their true feelings when they're telling a lie, because they don't want to show how they're actually feeling about it. However, doesn't matter how good a liar that you are, right before you tell your lie, it's just like a few milliseconds, you will show an emotional expression that will show your true feelings or your true, what really happens. So if you're saying like, oh no, I never killed someone and ripped off their arms, but you just have a very happy face, but true emotion of like horror or whatever that you feel while you're doing that, which slightly show before you lie about it. So how they tested this is by letting people watch different types of videos, and often they were very gory horror videos, but there were a couple of like limbs lying around and lots of blood. And then they asked those people after to tell about the video, but if they watched this cutesy little cartoon with like a little fluffy bunny running through like a grass field or something like that. And when people did that, they were quite good at concealing their true emotions of what they saw, and describing this video that they never saw. But very briefly, you saw this emotion of like the terror on their face when they thought back about what they actually watched.
Mm-hmm.
So based on this, the idea came about micro expressions, and that you can determine on those very brief flashes of emotion in a few milliseconds that you could determine if someone is lying or not. The issue with that is that the evidence was a little bit overstated and people started to use this and like, oh, we can train people to pick up on it. It turns out that you actually have to videotape someone talking about something and really slowly play the video, and then you might be able to see it. And again, it's an emotion and you don't know why they're showing the emotion. Are they doing it because they're lying or because they're maybe afraid of something else, or it triggered another memory, or they're super afraid that you are accusing them of something. Yeah.
Could you sit down though with one particular person and do a case study of one person and go, ah, that's your tell. That's your thing that you do when you lie a statistically significant amount of the time, and after hours and hours and hours of, you know, collecting data, be able to measure micro expressions and say with any reliability whether they're lying or not?
I would not know, because I personally haven't done that.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know, though, and you probably have it with the people around you as well, is that once you know someone really well and you know their mannerisms and you know how they respond in certain situations, you know the tone of their voice, you know how they speak, how they behave. So if you know them well, you would be able to compare when they're lying to the baseline. You would know something is off. Mm-hmm. It might not be they're lying, but you can pick up on that. So in theory, you could do that with an individual. You can monitor them. You can see what their baseline is. You can see them in their natural environment. You can see them in a high intense environment, and then compare when you're interviewing them about a specific part. And probably also with the micro expressions. The issue is that, well, especially in the field that I'm in, is that within an investigative procedure or process, that police officers don't have time to track somebody for like a few days, put them in all different situations to determine what their baseline is, to then compare them to specific parts, to compare them under high stress when they're being interviewed to determine if they're lying.
Yeah, you can't really get the investigating officer to kind of enter into a long-term relationship with the suspect. That's a sitcom right there, is you get,
yeah,
you know, murder suspects and cops having to live together to find out their micro expression in the Big Brother house. Oh, that's great. That's the future of law enforcement right there.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is what they did with the Wizards project, which, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, and it was to do with micro expressions, but that was saying not that there are, basically saying that instead of having to, as you said, like record people's micro expressions and play them back in slow motion and those kind of things, that there were certain people who were wizards, truth wizards, who could tell us, you know, 80-90% of the time that person is lying, and just have this natural kind of ability with no training.
That was Paul Ekman and a colleague, and they tested 15,000 people.
Wow.
They found that 50 of those had that natural ability and they were truth wizards. So they said, like, every time that we show them something, and they did look at micro expressions, but also at overall, they were more like, they were more attuned with human behavior, and they could look at specific aspects that might be indicative of lying. And they found that these people were very consistent in detecting the truth. And I think it was one of them, they have one case study that they describe, that she claimed that she was right 95% of the time when she was trying to detect a lie. And that's really high, and specifically because we know detecting a lie on a chance level anyway, because mm-hmm. you're either right or wrong. So this woman is consistently above chance level. Now, there were other researchers, and they did a follow-up on this study, because they were like, oh, well, that sounds a little bit too good to be true, and it technically was. So they were not very clear in their experimental design, as in how they tested it. How they tested if these people were actually truth wizards and were right almost 100% of the time. And what they found is that with a statistical error type thing, they said, like, oh, the reason that they scored as high could actually be caused by a statistical error and doesn't necessarily have to mean that these people are right. So there is some controversy in regards to if they actually exist or not, those truth wizards.
Yeah, I read the entire paper. I read a bit of the original paper and the one from Bond and Usel, I think it is. Usel, yeah. Which basically pointed out the error, the statistical error. Yeah. And then I read, it was Maureen O'Sullivan, who was the other with Eichmann, who did it. And then I read her response to that, and it got a little bit heated. There was a bit of, in the academic paper, there was a bit of sarcasm and comments about people, Bond and Ursel complain about this and they say this, but what they've got to remember. And it sort of descended into very short, like much shorter papers and a lot of trying to...
people, it's just like backwards and forwards.
Yeah, people trying to defend their 20 years of work, which is probably what I would be doing in that situation. Mm. I guess the other thing is that in that case, you have someone like Paul Eichmann, who is not just someone who has based his academic career on that study, but also his public persona, because he's someone who is famous as being an expert on lie detection. I said, are you an expert on lie detection? And you hemmed and hawed and evaded the question. Well, he's absolutely an expert on lie detection, but he is someone who has sort of, he's known, there is a character on TV based on him. On the TV show Lie to Me is, that's based on him. So if this turned out to be wrong, he can't just sort of say, oh, well, I retract my study, or yes, they're correct. He has a little bit more to lose in that kind of argument.
I think it's not necessarily wrong. Like in science, it's always your theory is as good until someone's better theory comes along, or until someone proves that you're not right.
Hmm.
There's a lot of issues at the moment within psychology with replication, and that people have these amazing findings, but then other researchers struggle to replicate it. Well, the original study is still out there and no one publishes afterwards on that specific topic because they cannot find the same results and all results don't get published. What I think with Paul Eichmann is that besides from his lie detection research, he's also done a lot with emotion research, and that is such strong and good research. So it's tricky. Like, there's a lot at stake for him, but then no one has to actually force him, because if he would have been, like, justifiably completely wrong, he should have retracted everything, and he hasn't done that still, and they haven't forced him to. Mm. And sometimes journals can themselves decide, like, oh, well, we no longer support this, what you've published, because there's too much counter-arguments now or counter-evidence, so they will retract it themselves. I know that Lie to Me stopped at a certain point because there were some issues with the research, and they said, oh, it might be a bit overstated.
Yeah.
Findings. And I think that is in the end what happened with microexpressions. Yes, they're useful. Yes, they're there. But we have to be careful in how useful they are and how much that we state they serve a certain, like they can fill a certain purpose.
One of the things that I've noticed with lie detection, and this happens in psychology in general, is that the idea of being able to tell whether someone is lying by micro expressions or lie detection or polygraphs is a lot more interesting and powerful than the idea that, well, results are inconclusive, or no, you can't, or you can in certain situations. Like, I can't imagine you giving a TED talk, like I said, a highly successful 15-minute TED talk in which you go through these things one by one and say, well, there might be some evidence here, whereas... there are dozens of lectures and short, pithy things that point out, I'm going to turn you into a human lie detector, or I'm going to show you the secrets of how to spot liars. And often those things are either, based on what you're saying, they're either not true, or they're overstating the case, or the cover says one thing, but the inside of the book says another. Is that frustrating for you as a psychologist to see the work that is being done sort of presented in that way, sort of sexed up, I guess.
Misrepresented,
oh. I guess. I was going to say sexed up, but misrepresented maybe is a better word. Yeah.
That's technically a lot of science at the moment, actually, where people read the abstract, misinterpret the abstract, and then write a whole article on it, or a blog post, or a YouTube video, when they haven't completely understood or fully read what was actually done. And it is really frustrating with research in itself that you try to, like, you always find little bits, and the little bits make up the bigger picture. It's little parts of the puzzle that make the big picture. But then even for us to not be able to say 100%, that is science. Like, you would be a bad scientist if you say this is absolutely 100% true, because you always work with a certain certainty interval. I don't like when I talk about lie detection. I actually don't mind it. I start a lot of my lectures or the talks that I give also to legal professionals with, so today I'm going to talk about lie detection and specifically all the nonverbal cues, for example, and I'm going to make sure that by the end of my talk, you are excellent lie detectors. And then I go through the whole talk and say, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. So then by the end, when I finish up, I say like, so when I said at the start that I was going to make you a perfect lie detector, so I was lying to you and you didn't even catch on to that. So that's always the moral of the story. And even if they don't remember anything, that's what they will remember.
What is their response to that? Like, what do they do when they realize that they've been had?
Normally they laugh, but some people can get a bit agitated because they're just like, I sat through this for an hour for this,
yeah.
for nothing. I think it's really important, though. I work on an innocence project here. I direct an innocence project here where we look at cases of possible wrongful convictions. And what often happens within a forensic context is that people do believe that they can determine if someone is lying, and they read those one or two pages, they read that one abstract, or they hear about the they're looking up to the rights, they're going in their fantasy of their brain, so they are lying. And because they have that assumption of this person lying, they will interview him in a specific way, him or her in a specific way, and they can create a tunnel vision over the whole investigation. So instead of following multiple leads, they will focus on this one person based on wrong ideas on if someone is lying or not. And then a person can be wrongly convicted. So in general, I think it's quite amusing if people have these misconceptions about lie detection. I've given up in trying to inform people just in my social life.
I'm really glad you say that, because I have, yeah. we recently had an episode I called The Ethics of Mentalism. So mentalism is like a branch of magic where you pretend to have psychic powers and, you know, that kind of thing. And it's great, except one of the routines that mentalists like to do is to pretend that they are a human lie detector. So everyone everyone takes a ball out of a bag and they put it behind their back, and the mentalist can tell by their facial expressions and their body language and all of this sort of stuff whether they're lying or telling the truth. And it's a magic trick, you know, like it's smoke and mirrors. It's got nothing at all to do with psychology.
Yeah.
And I've done it myself and then sort of went, oh, that's actually a bit dodgy. But it's so hard to explain to people why, you know, people are disappointed when they find out that's not true.
Yep.
And they don't understand that maybe you shouldn't be sort of spreading that kind of bad science because it has repercussions.
On the other hand, it's as well, like they're misinformed via so many sources. It's like it's TV shows, which I all love, because when you're talking about The Mentalist, well, The Mentalist, the TV show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
And I love all the cop shows as well, and I love to watch them. They watch Making a Murderer like 10 hours, and they believe that they can solve any wrongful conviction within a week because they watch Making a Murderer in a week. There's a lot of optimism and not a lot of criticism when they encounter specific information. And even when they believe they're very critical, and I think this comes together again, for example, with idea of fake news, fake information, fake facts, is that they are on Facebook and there is a webpage that says, I effing love science. And because it has science in there and because it has a nice little picture of science, something scientific, they say, well, it's based on a real study, that must be true. And they come up with all these facts, and often things reported on there are true and they got into the points, but very often as well, they misread something or misinterpreted something or misrepresented a specific finding because they didn't actually took the effort to go through the whole article, but just read the abstract. On one hand, it's frustrating because everyone is an expert nowadays. On the other hand, it's quite amusing.
Yeah, I guess it's that thing of the story is often, I mean, this is what we're talking about, the story is more interesting than the science. So the story of the human lie detector, the freak of nature who can tell who's lying or not, is much more interesting than the you know, I mean, I, like I said, I almost read the studies. I got halfway through and then it got into the hard statistics and I had, yeah.
But you're making very broad assumptions. Like in the end, when you discuss your findings, you say, oh, so this could relate to a real life situation like blah, blah, blah. But meanwhile, what you've done is you've tested 100 participants in a laboratory setting where you very artificially forced them to create this specific behavior and then lie about it. So there's also a slight disconnect at times between science and the claims that we make based on that. And because of that, we're very careful in saying, okay, well, yes, we might be able to use this, but there's always this uncertainty. Or people just want to know, like, yes or no, does it help or not, does it work? And as you said, the idea or the story behind it, being able to do that is heaps more exciting than, oh, we ran this little study where we compared a little bit and then maybe found this.
Yeah, that's right. Is it, do you think with, I mean, as someone, because you're someone who has worked both academically with in the topic, but also practically with the Not Guilty project, is it something where perhaps the focus should be on how can we tell when people are telling the truth as opposed to telling when people are lying? Which I know maybe just sounds like splitting hairs, but if I wanted to be able to tell whether, be able to spot a liar every single time, I just call everyone a liar and then I have 100% hit rate.
Yep.
And that's kind of what we do now is you get YouTube videos where people go fake underneath or this isn't true or they will refuse to accept something because it's better to accuse someone of being a liar and be wrong than it is to fall for their lies, if that makes sense. So yes. The sort of teaching people how to spot someone who's telling the truth or knowing when to believe someone or knowing when to doubt, as you said, you know, to doubt your own instincts on those kind of things seems like a more important skill than finding a human lie detector. Is that accurate or am I just being a bit airy-fairy?
It depends, of course, in which field that you're interested. So within, if you look what's going on now with all the fake news and everything, don't always want to go back to the United States because that's like the main topic of discussion level in a lot of different fields at the moment. But it would be good if people, could make a distinction. Like, when do we actually have to believe the claim of this is fake news or this isn't real? When can we actually determine if something is real or not? And within the general community, there's different ways that you can go about it. So very simple, if you're reading something, this is not necessarily when someone is directly talking to you, but if you're reading something like check the source, check the dates, see like where you found it, who they're quoting. If you're talking to someone else, what they found that sometimes helps as a truth verification method is content analysis. So not looking at how people are talking, but looking at what they are saying. And it was first developed in Germany for kids that made accusations of sexual abuse. And what they did is they interviewed the child, they made a transcript, and then there were 19 criteria that they based their decision on. And they said, like, the more these criteria are present, and you could score either 0, 1, or 2 points on every criteria, so the higher your score, the more likely it was that that statement was actually the truth. They have then transformed that to also apply not just to sexual abuse cases, but to a wide variety of crimes and also to make it applicable to adults. And what they found is that it is quite good in finding, so based on what they're saying, if this person is telling the truth, but it's not very good in detecting if someone is lying. Again, lying is that same thing that all the other cues have.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is, like, it's really difficult to, when you're talking to someone and you just quickly want to find out if they're lying or not, you cannot sit there with your 19 criteria. Because one issue, and just sitting there ticking boxes. And one issue is as well, like, I can make a statement such as, like, I had sushi last night for dinner. And if I would go past all the criteria, I would have, like, 1 point. It is the truth, though. So it's also depending on how much information that you provide. And the more information that you provide, the more criteria that you can tick or not tick. So it is really tricky in other situations. But I think the best way to actually determine if someone is lying or not is to have actual knowledge about certain facts. and then see if they contradict those facts or not, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's like giving them a little piece of truth as a bait and seeing what they do. So rather than, yeah, okay, giving them a piece of truth and seeing what they do with it, as opposed to kind of looking at their statements and kind of trying to guess if they're lies or not.
Also, right? When you're asking them about a specific event and you know certain facts, and then just see how do they talk about certain facts. Are they telling the truth about those facts or not? So you're verifying if they're truth telling towards stats. And if they already start lying about that, then it's a little bit like, oh, well, that's a bit sus.
Yeah. Okay.
That's like, in the end, just like, in my opinion, there is no simple solution to the problem.
I'm sure if you went outside and went down across to the philosophy, you know, like, department, not that you would, of course, dream of doing that, but you would find, you know, them sitting there, you know, scratching their beards and saying, what is truth and what is, you know, what is reality? Yeah. Like, this is trying to find a psychological answer to a philosophical question, to like, in some sense.
That's a point where you made yourself at the start already, where you said that what if you start to believe it yourself, you convince yourself of a lie. So you actually believe now that what you initially said is now the truth.
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah. This is one issue, and this is when I go into wrongful convictions, because what we're doing is we're assessing cases of sometimes 20, 30 years ago, and we only have the facts that were, for example, presented during the trials, and we might have some, we've got all the interviews with the suspects and with the witnesses, and you're going past that. But one main issue is already that your memory, what a lot of people believe is quite a good like fact checker, because this is what you witnessed, this is what you saw, these are the facts. You've been interviewed, you stated this in court, this is the truth. We cannot even rely on that, because we know that a lot of different factors can influence our memory. Over time, our memory decays, the questions that are asked can actually change our memory in such a way that we start to remember things in different lights. Even how we feel at a moment that we're trying to remember something can change how we remember it. So we're trying now, 20 years later, to determine the truth and the facts that happened then based on information that might already be biased. And I think in our nowadays society, even though that people are very anti, like, oh, the internet is all accelerating this production and spread of things, on the other hand, it's also helping us to, when somebody witnesses something or sees something, they can take a photo, they can take a video. And that is, like, a video is always 10,000 times better than what your memory is.
Is it something where you now have, because the memory is also usually of a traumatic event, that the memory is, it may be false because obviously, you know, the issues that you said, but it's going to be strong. Like, it's going to be a strong memory because, one, they've come back to it over and over again, but also it's an emotional, you know, traumatic event that sticks with them. So, do you have people who are not only like wrong in what they remember, but also perhaps more certain about this thing that they're wrong about than they would be about other topics?
Yes, the confidence increases. So what we sometimes see is something called confidence inflation. And that is when people are actually a little bit uncertain at the time that they have to make a decision. For example, with an identification, so they saw someone committing a crime or were a victim of a crime, they have to identify them from a lineup. They're not really sure. They're like, it could be that one, very uncertain. But because the confirmation of, now that person is going to be prosecuted, a year later they're in court, they become more and more confident in a wrong decision. And it happens with overall recall memories as well. So something happens, they try to recall it, and often you try to make sense of it in your brain. And if you only focus, for example, on the traumatic part, you might lose the context, and you try to fill in the gaps of how it happened, when it happened, and it can be filled in with wrong information. But you become very confident because, like, I clearly remember this, and it is like it happened yesterday, it happened 2 minutes ago, and it's like so fresh in my brain. And you keep on reaffirming yourself the wrong information within that part and become very confident about it.
And that makes your job with the project very hard, because you must have people who who are perhaps guilty, or, you know, perhaps they're in prison for a reason, and yet they have convinced themselves by misremembering that they are innocent. And so they come to you as people who truly believe they are innocent.
Yeah.
If people want to find out more about the project, it's called Not Guilty, the Sydney Exoneration Project. Yes. And it's psychologists and lawyers at the University of Sydney teaming up, which is, that's like that. See, there's another sitcom right there. Psychologist and lawyer having to work together. It's like it's a buddy cop movie.
It's always a nice little interaction that we see between the two fields.
Excellent. We should bring in
They complement each other very nicely.
You should bring in some philosophers, give them something to do as well.
Make the party complete.
Exactly. Right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. My last question for you is, are you now a better liar than you were at the start of your study into this topic? Like, do you think you can tell better lies, or do you think you now just have too much information and too much to work with and you're actually a worse liar?
I think people are either natural liars or not. Even people that know the signs, they often try to then overcompensate, so they come across very weird. I believe I was always quite a good liar.
Mm-hmm.
So have I become better? Maybe with practice, but not necessarily by learning more about the topic.
Well, I believe you, so clearly you're either right or even if you're lying, you're very, very good at it.
This has been Scammapalooza. Don't forget to check out conman.com.au for more information about today's episode.